This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
30 seconds to
air. What do you think about flowers? I think show notes
these are for the guests.
Pam, I need some more books for these mics.
Anyone have the promo for the show notes?
Wait, where's the Fiji water? Is this tap water?
15 seconds.
Can somebody get the cat?
I can't drink tap water.
Can someone tell Joe's mom to stop vacuuming?
It's not hard to find.
Has anybody seen my hair gel?
Artesian water. Natural.
Quiet on the set. Live in 3, 2.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and what home is in your future? We'll talk about how millions of people are leaving hundreds of thousands of dollars behind when buying or selling their house with Marin County, California's top real estate pro, Tracy McLaughlin. Plus, are great charts and graphs a necessity for an advisor to serve you well? We'll keep it futuristic while we discuss advisors, technology, and your planning in our headline segment. And we're going to really need to wind up the old pitching arm today because we're tossing the Haven Lifeline all the way over to Mumbai, India for Niranjan, who has a question about refinancing. And of course, I'll also save time for some of my incredible, or should I say amazing, maybe awesome, yeah, that's the right word, awesome trivia. And now, two guys I've had my eye on for years now, Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
Welcome to Monday. Yes, you made it, and we're here to greet you on the other side. Welcome to a brand new week. I am Joe Salcihi, Average Joe Money on Twitter. And across the card table from me, the exclusive co-host on Westwood One's exclusive, for now, Chatty Finance Podcast, it's Mr. OG.
I like the exclusiveness. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It is a manic Monday. Don't you wish it was Sunday?
That's my fun day. I don't have to run day.
I don't have to run day.
Yeah. Right. We just came up with that. How was your weekend, man?
A song out of that.
If only they did.
It's summertime. I can't complain about anything.
But you know what, OG? A great way to start your week is with studentloanhero.com, because when you go to Student Loan Hero, you'll find out not just are there some fantastic ways for you to catch up on student loans right now between lower interest rates, some great help for some student loan people with the CARES Act, but there are also ongoing programs all the time when it comes to student loans. So whether it's a Parent Plus loan, a federally subsidized loan, unsubsidized loans, or commercial loan, it's all there at studentloanhero.com. Great show today. Tracy McLaughlin joins us. She is a top California realtor. She's written a fantastic book, OG, about people selling their house and about how a lot of people do it wrong. So we're going to talk about house selling and house buying basics. But first, we have some headlines, so let's get into it.
Hello, darlings. And now, it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's Headlines.
Our first headline comes to us from financialplanning.com, a website for financial planners. This piece is written by Ryan W. Neal. Financial Planning just had their Tech Survey 2020. And the headline here, which I wanted to get your take on, is advisors losing faith in planning software. Piece reads, in an age of shrinking compensation models and shifting regulatory landscapes, digitally driven financial plans are the future when it comes to keeping and attracting clients, or so you'd think. But the latest financial planning tech survey suggests a growing number of advisors are concluding that financial planning software is not the silver bullet they'd hoped for and are reevaluating the value it brings to their practices. 20% of advisors say they're currently not using any financial planning software, a 16-point increase from the 2019 study.
Because not doing math will always be doing math.
I find that incredible. And don't get me wrong, I don't know how the landscape looks now, but I do remember, OG, some advisors who would just completely lean on the software, right? Well, the software says that we have to, the software.
Right.
I think the software is a great tool to set milestones and to help people do if-then scenarios. If you save another $200 a month, here's what happens. If one of the two of you passes away and expenses stay 80% of what they are today for the family, here's how that looks for the rest of the family. Like, you can do a lot. Why wouldn't you use any software at all?
It's confusing. I mean, the interesting thing about financial planning, of course, is that your financial plan is outdated the minute you hit print, because the next day you have more data, right? You have new information. But by the same token, you can't constantly be refreshing that on a day-to-day basis. Take, for example, somebody who redid their financial plan January 15th this year. Market's doing pretty good. Nothing to worry about. There's no such thing as killer bees yet or corona, you know.
Remember those days?
I know.
We should have been, by the way, skipping. And I'm not saying that flippantly. We should have been skipping all the way to the basement every day.
Yeah. So now you are 4 or 5 months past, right? More information. But by the same token, yeah, your plan for this year may not have worked out, but you don't know yet. You don't know if it's worked out. Our message this next half of the year with clients is not, we have to redo the whole thing. It's not, well, gosh, we got to throw the whole plan out and start over again. It's, let's just give it some time. I mean, you can just see from a market standpoint, yeah, it went down a whole bunch. It's also gone up a whole bunch. Nobody has any idea what the future holds. Nobody. So let's just give it some time. But by the same token, it doesn't hurt to do, like you mentioned, what if scenarios. And okay, what happens if, and I'm thinking bigger term things, not like what happens if the market doesn't recover this year and it takes 2 years. I'm thinking like, what if Social Security doesn't exist for people who are in their 40s? That's a planning thing that you can think about today and very difficult to model out deterministically, you know, on like an Excel worksheet or something.
But I remember even doing that with things even more under our control. Like, what if we bought the bigger house versus the smaller house and kept investing more money?
Sure. Or what if I paid my mortgage off in 15 years instead of 30?
Right. What if I had, what if we,
the difference?
What if we had a baby and our expenses went up by 20% for the family?
Or you had two babies at the same time.
That would never happen.
Never happens in real life. I know, but it's a planning scenario. So
right. Exactly. I know advisors are still using Microsoft Excel and a piece of paper, basically, says William Trout, head of wealth management research firm Celent. Of course, an 80% user rate is very high for an industry typically slow to adopt new technology, but the decrease contradicts popular wisdom about the direction of the advice industry, the piece says. It could be planning technology so widespread it no longer provides a real competitive advantage for firms, Trout suggests. I don't know what firm wants to say, hey, you need to hire me because I use MoneyTree or I use eMoney when I do. Nobody knows what the hell that is. They just want to know that you're, to your point earlier, they just want to know you're doing some math.
Or worse, hire me because I know how to use my HP 10B2 and a piece of legal paper and a pencil. I don't know. I mean, you remember the days, you know, back in the day, Joe, back when we were young financial planners. But I was telling this story to some people on my team that remember the software that we had at American Express where you would put all the data in and then you'd hit solve and you would have enough time from the time you hit solve to go get a cup of coffee, maybe go to the bathroom, talk to your buddy, have a sandwich, and then you'd come back and the program had solved the math. Do you remember that? How long it
was?
Like, you know, 10 or 12 minutes.
Yes.
And then you'd come back and you go, oh, I forgot their 401k contributions. And you have to, you know, put the information back in again and redo it again.
And not only that, this is the horrible part. Each time it was nearly impossible to look at it on the screen. Nearly every time in the early days, we had to print it all out.
Yeah.
And I sat there with the paper and I get to page 85 and I go, none of this plan is good.
Start over.
There goes another tree.
Do another one. Yeah. And now how modular it is, I don't see why you can't or why you don't use, you know, technology. It's not inexpensive. That's the thing. Technology and the service that it provides, you have to look at it as an investment. It's not a cost, because it would take so much more energy and effort, and of course trees, to, you know, to actually be able to do all of that calculation, where we can just click a button and have it done almost instantaneously at this point.
Rich Keltner, Tegra 118's director of product management, says advisors may be focusing less on making new plans and more on portfolio management and investment products to help current clients get through the current market volatility in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. Hey, I got an idea. Here's what we do, guys. There's a hurricane outside. Let's get rid of all the compasses. I don't get it. I don't think technology is important. I think the math behind your financial plan, pretty important. Our second headline comes to us from Yahoo Money. This is written by Dara Singh. Half of Americans took from retirement savings or plan to amid pandemic, survey finds. Does that shock you?
No. What would be more shocking is if they contrasted that against just a normal everyday period of time and see what the answer is, because I bet the number is very similar.
The number's probably got to be in the 30% range, people that just touch it anyway.
Yeah. Like, right? Ooh, thing, touch.
Don't touch your retirement plan. You go blind.
Touched. Exactly.
What if we put that out there? Get your hand out of that cookie jar. Nearly half of Americans dipped into their retirement accounts recently or considering the move, according to a new survey. 3 in 10 Americans withdrew $6,757.20.
Gosh, they're so precise in their withdrawals. You'd think the average American would have just rounded to like 6,500.
Can you see that call to Fidelity? And 20
I'd
cents.
Like to take a withdrawal from my 401k plan. Oh, okay, sir. No problem. How much is you like? Ooh, I'm going to go $6,781.11, please.
Guys like, whoa.
After tax.
I just got to tell you, sir, everybody else is taking $67,57.20.
I'm above average.
In the last 2 months, that's the statistic, by the way, according to an online survey of 1,239 Americans with a retirement savings from personal finance site Magnify Money, sponsor of this show, and also sister site of the sponsor of this particular episode. Another 2 in 5 plan to do so soon, the survey found. Findings come as jobless claims surpass 36 million, leading Americans to dig into their savings to stay afloat. Recent provisions from the CARES Act also ease penalties for early withdrawals up to $100,000 due to coronavirus-related hardships, making the move less burdensome. I understand that people need money, and I also understand the government's willingness to let people forego penalties to get at that money, OG. But what do you think about this, though, as what seemingly looks like for a lot of people, their first line of defense when they run out of money?
It's super detrimental. Think of it this way. Even with all of the benefits that they provided for in the CARES Act, right? The reduced payback period time, or I guess the increased payback period time, I guess you could say, accessibility. I think, did they double the amount? Did they even go from 50K to 100K out of your 401K?
It is 100K, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, all this flexibility, it's so hard to put yourself in those shoes and say, well, this is really, really, really a terrible idea for you, because I'm assuming that they're doing as best as they can with the information that they have, right? You know, so if you're dipping into your 401k, I'm assuming that you've exhausted every other opportunity. but I wonder how many people kind of use it as a crutch. And what I mean by that is saying, like, I don't have to really stretch, or I don't really have to, you know, watch my expenses that much because I've got 100 grand in my 401k I can go get. And the government says they're not going to penalize me to do it. There are certainly a lot of circumstances where, hey, this is the only way to pay the mortgage. And it is what it is at that point. But I wonder how many of these are opportunities where maybe just a little bit more effort, if you know what I mean, like in terms of trying to figure it out or using different alternatives or even something drastic, like just going, hey, well, we just can't afford this anymore. You know, we're going to have to move or whatever without going into it. Cause I mean, we talk about this all the time in terms of the power of compounding, and we just can't figure it out in our brains. It's just not a thing that works in our head. The idea of the benefit of compounding, we can do additive things pretty easily, kind of physiologically, but like the idea that I can take this $10,000 and it's really worth $500,000, just it does not compute. And so when you see those withdrawals and you see a $6,000 or $7,000 withdrawal, you go, ah, it's $6,000 or $7,000. But we're trying to remind everybody it's not $6,000 or $7,000. It's more like $60,000 or $70,000.
Or $100,000 or $200,000.
Yeah.
Depending on how young you are.
If it's really something important, so be it. But if there's any opportunity to not do this, you just have to let it go and try a different route.
It goes hand in hand with that headline that we did last week about how Americans can't do things because they have too much debt. This is another way that we're just mortgaging our future to be able to live today. And that never, it just never ends well.
Yeah. And I know that there's some people, maybe even a lot of people, maybe the majority of people who didn't have a choice, right? Like this was it. This was the final straw. And all there was to it was I got to use this money for my retirement plan. But it's so difficult. Just think about like all the other dominoes that go with this. So when did we most likely take the money out? March or April, right? Like that's when things were the worst. I'm already taking $7,000 out that was worth $10,000 or $11,000 a few weeks ago. You know, so I withdrew the shares worth $10,000 or $11,000 in February. Today they're worth six. And now I've got to pay it back. And when am I going to pay it back? Well, if I took it out in March or April, it's probably gone up from now. And even if I pay it back over the next 3 or 4 years, it's likely to be at a higher share price. So I got to pay that back at a higher share price. And, you know, the tax implications, all these other things, it's like, oh, you're just hammering all of the bad news all at the same time. So the real question, I guess, is how do you get out of all of this? If you happen to be the person that took $6,725, whatever you said it was out, you have to drop everything. If things are back to normal from a financial standpoint in your world, if you're working or if you didn't experience the layoff that you thought or whatever the case may be, you have to move mountains to get that money back in. Because the longer that it takes to replenish that account, the more in terms of time value money, compounding, interest payments, all that stuff it costs you. So I've always been taught there's two types of pain in life, slow pain and fast pain. So just figure out a way to make this really fast pain. And if you took $6,700 out of your 401k and you can pay it back, don't pay it back over 5 years. Pay it back over 5 weeks. Figure out a way to make it happen.
Another point on this we should bring up, Aaron Clark, an advisor at Halperin Financial, says that if bankruptcy is an option you're considering, if your back is truly against the wall, you should leave the funds in your 401k plan alone. Halperin says your 401k assets are protected from creditors under ERISA laws. Whether IRAs are protected from creditors varies by state. So if your money's in a 401k and your back is truly, truly against the wall, I wouldn't raid your 401k to pay as many bills as possible, get halfway done, and then declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, keep it in your workplace plan if you can.
Yep. Yeah. I think lesson number one, 401k plan, last place to go if you need money, or definitely your last line of defense. And also, I think our other takeaway, your advisor says, hey, I got this without using any numbers. Might be time for some new help. Tracy McLaughlin is a person who knows real estate better than most. Listen to this. She took Pacific Union International and made it the fifth largest brokerage in the United States. She's also one of the top real estate experts in the country. And something I know from recently going through a real estate transaction myself, OG, there is so much that we don't know. And there's so much that we get wrong when we try to buy or sell a house. And I often think, and we've talked about this on roundtables, even our roundtables, OG, have been split around whether you should buy or sell a house yourself or have a professional involved. And yet, when you see the difference that somebody that understands the market, I don't care if it's a realtor, a real estate professional, but just somebody who understands how to do anything, whether it's somebody who really knows landscaping, somebody who knows calculus, somebody who knows how to do taxes, having the right professional in your corner can often save you and also sometimes create for you tons of money. So today we're going to talk about how do we get more money out of our real estate. Let's say hello to Tracy McLaughlin. And on my dad's shortwave, it's our new friend, Tracy McLaughlin. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great, Joe. How about yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. And before we start, just the lengths you and I went to make this happen are pretty unbelievable. You can tell that we really want to talk real estate today, Tracy.
I know. Thank you for being so patient. Nice to meet you, Joe.
Yeah, well, nice to meet you. Hey, during your introduction, we talked about ahead of time your impressive credentials, but we didn't really talk about your past. And I'm always interested about how successful people got where they are. So why you in real estate? What was the attraction you had to the real estate market?
Well, you know, I kind of fell into it backwards. I had been in television news and a co-host of a television program on international travel and skiing. Was expecting my first child. I could no longer jump out of helicopters in Russia or whatever we were doing. So I started buying homes in the neighborhood that I was living in and had a knack for understanding how to fix them up and flip them and make some money. So I started really backwards. I didn't have a license. I was using an agent and buying things. And all of a sudden people were saying, oh, well, you're always out looking. If you see this, why don't you let me know? So anyway, got licensed, had no idea with a journalism background that I'd ever become a real estate agent. I thought it was somewhere, you know, a few hairs off of being a used car salesperson. I never could have seen myself doing real estate. And I fell in love with the business very, very accidentally.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I was an English creative writing major, which is why I run a financial podcast now. You know, sometimes the disconnect, but I think something maybe, Tracy, that you and I have in common then is you kind of look at real estate the way that your client looks at real estate, not like the average real estate geek looks at it.
That's correct. I tend to look at real estate as an asset. I mean, here in California, it is a lot of people's bank accounts is their homes. We've just had an 8-year run of, you know, 7 to 10% appreciation a year in some of these houses in places like Atherton and San Francisco and certain neighborhoods. So I tend to look at real estate as an asset. Sometimes I even call it that instead of a house. I'm all about guiding people in terms of how to monetize that best when you go to sell it and or in the purchase process.
You say in your book that a person's house is a huge part of their net worth. You had a surprising number. I don't remember what it was.
It's 40% of America's wealth is tied up in its primary residence.
What's amazing is 40%, and yet we don't trust real estate experts, right? By and large, you've seen this. People tend to believe their own numbers versus a, quote, real estate expert. Why is that?
Well, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. So you got a double whammy here. Most of us are emotionally tethered to where we live. I mean, we've created our memories there. We've had our children there, Hanukkah, Christmas, celebrations, births, deaths, whatever it is. So in that asset is all of these memories, and thus you've got an emotional attachment. And so because you're emotionally tethered to the house and a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, buyers and sellers, consumers of homes have immediate access to information now, unlike they ever did even 30 years ago, where they really had to rely on the guidance and counsel of a real estate agent. So now with a click of a button, Zillow tells me this, and I think my house is worth that or more because of the emotional attachment to it. So you start to build a case for your own home's value in your head that's really largely based on your emotional attachment to it. You don't really have a lot of objectivity around that. Plus, access to information that doesn't have a complete filtration system. I mean, there's no way the algorithm of Zillow understands that your paint color is too yellow and not a crisp white, which actually makes a huge difference in terms of marketability and sale. Zillow can't go in and understand that there's stains or rust on your cooktop and it makes your house feel old, and thus buyers will not value it that way. So the nuances of evaluation of your home really largely need to be done through the guidance and counsel of somebody who really understands evaluations.
So is the problem bad agents out there, or is the problem that we aren't good at figuring out what a good agent looks like?
I think it's both, actually. Listen, if you're managing somebody's stock portfolio, you've got to have an undergraduate degree, take a Series 7. You've got all sorts of checks and balances around the management of somebody's money. There's just all sorts of disclaimers, disclosures, even on their email. So in our business, you have to be 18 years of age, go to about, I think, 60 hours of Anthony's school on average, and you can walk in and tell anybody what they want to hear. So the problem is twofold. It's really the fact that there are many people that are not qualified to be doing this. There should be higher levels of education, in my opinion, to get a real estate license, because you are managing people's money. That's what this comes down to.
But I believe, like I'm sure you do, Tracy, that I mean, in my life, I want to have good people in my corner, right? I want to have smarter people than me when I'm doing important transactions. And crap, if it's 40% of my net worth, this is one of the most important transactions I'm going to have. I mean, my real estate transaction is going to be hugely important. So how do we do a better job then of interviewing people to make sure that we get the right person in our corner and avoid some of those bad apples?
That's a great question. And what you want to do is, first of all, you want to filter out who are the top, let's call it five performers in your market. Okay. Chances are those people are consistently in the number one or five, one to five position in their rankings year after year, because about 10% of people in our business do 90% of the business. And that is consistent over the years. So chances are, if those people are consistently producing, they're consistently performing. And that performance, really, at the end of the day, we're in the business of relationships. I would tell people, I'm not really in the house business. I'm in the business of relationships and the longevity and the protection of those relationships. That happens with honesty, not telling people what they want to hear, but telling them what they need to know for the betterment of the sale of their home, and building a very long-term business where all you care about at the end of the day, whether you sold the house or not, was that you told the truth and that person was impressed by your knowledge and went and told five of their friends. That's how you build a long-term real estate career. So anyway, that's you want to check who's the top performer, and then you actually want to get on the phone and call five of their references. Every time I have a huge name in our industry, and I still hand people interviewing me a piece of paper and say, I welcome you to call all of these sellers, all these buyers, and talk to them about how I performed for them. So research the top people and then get on the phone and actually call their clients and find out what they're like to work with.
You talked about people overvalue their home, and they overvalue it for sentimental reasons. And in fact, it's interesting. Another statistic you had in your book was that the more we owe on our house, the more we overvalue it. If we owe a bunch of money, we think it must be worth a ton because I owe a ton. But if that's not the metric, the amount that I owe, what is the metric? What metrics do I use to fairly value my house?
Well, the metric that you should be using, now this gets a little complicated, but when you quantify a home, like a very seasoned appraiser does, I try to give people the visual of a cauldron. Put a big cauldron, pot of boiling water somewhere, and throw about 30 things into it that create value or detract from the value of your home. There are tangible things like the construction of the home, the finishes, the level of finishes, the floor plan, the layout, the desirability of the indoor-outdoor living, all sorts of things that are there that are very obvious. But then you have less tangible things that are very hard to quantify unless you really understand the nuances of valuation. How do you quantify phone lines in a view versus no phone lines? How do you quantify privacy and quiet? How do you quantify south facing with all day sun versus north facing and losing sun at 1 o'clock in the afternoon? So all of these things need to be put into a cauldron. And the way you evaluate your home is you take the square footage of your home, let's call it 3,000 square feet, and you understand the desirability of the home on a per square foot basis. This gets a little technical, but you're taking those 30 things and you go, well, that's about $750 a square foot because it has this, but it doesn't have that. You take those 30 things, you mix them around essentially, and you multiply the home square footage by the desirability of those things in the cauldron. And that's how we come up with valuation. It's a tricky thing. Most people don't understand. They go, well, this isn't just about my square feet, Tracy. I've got a pool that cascades over here, or look at my views of San Francisco, or whatever they think is so compelling. Those things are actually part of the value. It's a very, very complex process, actually.
But then I assume, based on your answer, that even if I'm not selling my home right now, Tracy, there are some things that I can do that are going to increase that price per square foot more than other things, right? Like the square footage is not created equal. So if I'm going to make my house more desirable for other people, kind of in order, what are some of the top things I can do to spike that number?
So the things you can do, go on Pinterest, go on House, flip open El Decor. Look at what is trending on those sites and in design magazines. And I don't care, the smallest budgets can actually be applicable here and help create tremendous value in your home. If you have old hardwood floors, do a new brown gray mix and cover the hardwood floors with a stain that's current. If your walls sing peach from the 1990s, get them a very crisp white and the right white on the walls. Those two things alone are transformative for how a house markets. If you've got, you know, old appliances, they don't have to be expensive appliances, but change them out in stainless. Everything in our business is about how homes get photographed. We have about 50 photographs to tell the story of a home. If there are elements of old peeking out in those photographs, you know, you've got, you know, the new floor is done, but guess what? You've got old crappy appliances and they show up in the photos. People immediately discount the rest of your home because they're seeing elements of old. So my formula is proven. I've done research all over the country and I've done 400 of these for people in the Bay Area. It's staining hardwood floors. It's changing carpet. It's neutralizing the wall color. Doing whatever you can with the more permanent finishes, like the bathroom countertops, the kitchen countertops. If you have a budget to do that, that's very important. And the most critical part of all this is the staging and styling of the home.
I want to ask you about that in a second, but just finishing off this particular topic, it sounds like all those things are fairly inexpensive. Like there's some really inexpensive stuff I can do, Tracy, that will make my house pop.
Absolutely. And even if you don't have the money, go take out a loan to do this. It's that critical. There is about a $5 to $7 or $8 return on every dollar invested, as long as you are being given the guidance of the appropriate selection of materials. I've seen people try and wing this without guidance. They go, but I painted my house gray, Tracy. I'm like, yeah, but guess what? You paint it, there's so much blue in that gray, you actually did the house a disservice. So if your real estate advisor isn't necessarily profound with this, get an interior designer who understands what color gray markets best or what color creamy white on the outside of the house, and get a set of design eyes in conjunction with your real estate advisor and spend the money appropriately. It's really critical.
I got to tell you, interior designer is somebody that was a bridge too far for me maybe 15 years ago. And then the office that I worked in, I was still a financial planner. The guy who I sold my business to had a designer come in and design our office. I went back and told my spouse, Cheryl, that we had to have a designer for our house, and it paid for itself. And it's funny because ever since then, even though I don't have a phenomenal eye, my eye's even gotten better, is the interior designer just did things and saved me so much money. I thought that it was going to be an expense. It was really, talk about assets, that interior designer paid for themselves just in spades.
Absolutely. Yes. Always. I always invest money in consultants who understand and know subjects better than I do. It's the best money spent, right? And watch the homes in your market that are selling very successfully. That's critical. Why did Joe's house three doors down sell very well and the other one languished for a year and a half? Split screen those images on your computer and understand why something sells quickly and for the most amount of money.
I've got just two more questions for you. One is on if I'm looking at remodeling my house, back to this idea that some remodels are probably worth more than others. For current trends right now, you know, we hear about kitchen, bathroom, gathering areas. What's probably the number one place where I can remodel and get the most bang for my buck?
It's the great room. It's the concept of the open great room. So listen, you can remodel to the nines, but if you have a compartmentalized kitchen and it's shut off from the flow in the space that we all use right now, which is a kitchen family room combination, you're wasting your money. Open up the wall and get some bar counter seating on the other side of that new wall opening with a peninsula or a big bar counter seating area. The flow and the spatial configuration around a kitchen family room is the most critical space that we live in today. And it's what's most valued by people. If I have a stunning home, you know, gorgeous finishes, but it's compartmentalized, and you're going to that room to eat and that room over there to watch TV and that room to cook, nobody wants it anymore. It doesn't matter how beautiful it is.
Last question I have is around pricing. A lot of the time when you meet with people, I'm sure people go, hey, let's list it for more. And then that will weed out all the people that aren't serious. But your strategy is exactly the opposite. And studies have shown that your strategy works a little better. Give me an idea of your strategy around pricing a house effectively to get more interest.
Absolutely. This is critical to understand. And this is not just applicable to hot markets in the Bay Area or hot markets in New York. I did research all over the country. I called my colleagues from Detroit down to Pensacola. If you think about what is the main driver of business, it's supply and demand, right? We are trying to get the highest price for a home. The best day you can have is when two people want your house at the same time. Because the if you price a home so that if someone says, oh my gosh, that is a great deal, I've got to jump on that house, chances are other people are doing the same thing. And the minute you've got competitive bids on a home and people are emotionally, they're already getting emotionally attached to it in the process, what happens is the inflationary pricing, that extra cream on the coffee or whatever you want to call it, comes as a result of somebody trying to take something from somebody else. So two people bidding on a house in bidder A says, oh my gosh, I have no idea what they're offering. I think I'm going to go up to here to take that house and not allow myself to lose it. Guess what? Up here is usually overpaying for the house. It's more than it's worth. It's more than it would have ever sold for if you do it in that order. When you overprice a home and nobody's buying it the first 1, 2, 3 weeks in most markets around this country, the first thing buyers do is look at the MLS and say, what's wrong with that house? Why didn't it sell? And guess what? You're no longer in a position of offense. You're playing defense. You're defending the home. You're telling people, oh, no, it's a great house. You got to come. It just, you know, we don't know why there hasn't been an offer, blah, blah. The minute you price your house exactly right, all you hear about is what's great about the house. When it's overpriced, all you hear is the buyer's objections. It doesn't have this. I don't like that. So pricing is critical, and you want to do it to drive traffic and competition into your home.
I love a story that you tell about somebody that you were working with that they wanted to price the house higher than you did. The person took your advice, and because you drove so much competition to the house, they actually got a price well above even what they thought the house was worth. Even though your starting price was much lower, they got a price well, well above what they wanted. The book is called Real Estate Rescue, How America Leaves Billions Behind in Residential Real Estate and How to Maximize the Value of Your Home. Man, we just touched on a few of these, Tracy, but you go over, I mean, finishes, you go over how to make room by room pop. There's a lot. There's some beautiful pictures, by the way, of some great looking houses that weren't great looking houses before. I'm reminded of one of my favorite books by Sarah Suzanka, which is The Not So Big House, which really shows how to make a house pop. The book's available everywhere, Tracy?
Yeah, available on Amazon in both audiobooks and buy it on Amazon along with everything else you're buying.
And if somebody wants to talk to you personally, by the way, how do they get a hold of you?
I'm reachable at Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, at TracyMcLaughlin.com. And you can go on my website, TracyMcLaughlin.com.
Sure. And you know what? If you're walking the dog, we've got you covered. We'll have the links to both the book and to Tracy's website on our show notes page at StackyBenjamins.com. Tracy, thanks a ton for helping us with real estate today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. It was great.
Hey, trivia fans, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And remember that scary story by Edgar Allan Poe called The Telltale Heart? Well, I only bring it up because Joe's mom's been asking lots of strange questions lately, like, I wonder who ate the last piece of chocolate cake, or, oh boy, it would sure be great if I had some chocolate cake right about now. And then she looks right at me. Can she hear my heart beating? Is she, like, in my head? She couldn't possibly know what happened to the cake, could she? That's crazy talk. Right? Well, while I go wipe off these sweats, you go ahead and take a guess at today's completely unrelated trivia question, which is this. Which branch of the United States intelligence community, known as the IC to those who are in the community like me, has the largest budget? I'll be back faster than you can spy on your neighbor with your answer.
The thrill of the financial markets. Clicking the order on another day trading win. Introducing the perfect coffee for that perfect moment when you've just nailed an upside down candlestick all-in move. Or that glorious time as the sun's coming up and you've pushed through the nighttime hours trading Tokyo, Hong Kong, Frankfurt and London exchanges and you just barely eked out that option harness that saved your ass before your $24.50 call expired. What's the perfect coffee for that moment? Pour yourself some. I got lucky again, brew. Imagine delicious trades and a fantastic taste. Sure, you might not sleep because that caffeine combines beautifully with your betting the farm lifestyle, but heck, it's nearly worth it because you found the perfect fix to keep you motoring. Staring at that monitor, waiting to squeeze out another quarter point on the VIX.
Every time I push the button on another Wisdom Tree Coffee 3x daily leveraged out of the money option, I sip on my I got lucky again brew and think, I got lucky again.
I haven't gotten lucky in weeks, but I'm still up all night trading.
Are you coming to bed?
Be there in a couple hours, honey. That doesn't stop me from drinking a cup or three of I got lucky again coffee.
Sure, coffee won't make you millions, but you'll feel like a million while you drink I got lucky again brew. Available now.
Hey, Stacker, it's your pal, Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug. And okay, I gotta tell you, it's continuing. I get that feeling somebody's watching me, and then I turn around and what do I see? Sure enough, it's Joe's mom standing at the bottom of the steps of the stairwell, just staring at me. I don't even know where the lady came from. First, with all the questions, and now she's stalking me. Sure, she had a laundry basket in her hand and talked nonchalantly about the weather, but we all know, she thinks I ate the cake. And I gotta figure out how. But before that, I need to slide you your trivia answer. Here we go. The question was, what branch of the United States intelligence community, also called the IC, has the biggest budget? The answer? While the entire IC makes up a whopping 11.3% of the defense budget, wow, that's a lot, it's the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, that commands the biggest slice. Like Joe's mom, it appears that they take watching people very seriously. Okay, now, time for some evasive maneuvers on my part. We will continue later. I gotta go.
Swing and a miss. You said NSA, yeah. And not it's the CIA.
That's what the NSA wants you to think, is that it's the CIA. Obviously.
How do we know that the NSA doesn't have as large of a budget? Bum, bum, bum. Big thanks to Tracy. You know, my favorite part of that discussion, OG, it was when she talked about the herd mentality, about selling your house, setting a slightly lower price. Like, everybody meets with the realtor. Like, how many times have you talked to people about this? Yeah, my real estate agent said we should start here, and I thought we should start way above that. Yet I think, well, not only do I think Tracy has a point, she has tons of data to prove that if you price your house a little bit lower and you encourage lots of bidders to come to the table, get a high price if the market's hot enough.
When we sold our house in Michigan, our realtor was a friend of ours. Nevertheless, we did a little bit of due diligence on his method, and he had a very similar approach, which was, I said, hey, I think that our house is worth more than this. He says, I know. I think it is too. But if we price it well enough that it attracts a lot of interest, he's like, you have to think about it like a funnel. We're trying to get people in the door right now. We'll worry about the price later, but if it's priced too high, then we just won't even get the people in the door. So let's get a lot of people interested. And then, hey, if it sells at this price, it sells at this price. So be it. It's a little lower. But I think, and this is what he said too, my research has suggested that if we get multiple people interested, they all kind of one up each other a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a little teeny tiny bit. Well, you know, what's another $1,000? What's another five? What's another $3,000? What's another $10,000? And all of a sudden, you got an offer that's above your asking. So that's what happened to us.
It's interesting. And then this idea that all rooms aren't created equal and unique features might be unique for a reason. Nobody else wants them.
Exactly.
Good stuff. But I'd never also thought about which way the house faces, and fascinating discussion.
Really? You never thought about like which way if it's facing northwest, something like that, like in terms of where the sun is.
I always think about that being, cool, right? Man, this is a great backyard and I could watch the sunset over here, or, you know, it's facing like my old house in Texas. If you remember, there was that little, I don't know if it was a big pond or a small lake behind our house.
But all I know is that we had the slip and slide going right into it.
Yeah.
Every week. So it was awesome.
It's fantastic. Could you imagine a slip and slide into that thing, that mud pit? Oh, that'd be just horrible. I don't know what people would dump into the, Think about clean watersheds.
Mosquitoes,
that's not one of them.
Mosquitoes didn't even live in there. You didn't even have a mosquito problem.
Look at this. It's mosquito free. I wonder why.
Exactly. It's bubbling, but it's mosquito free. Now, we thought about that when we moved here, just thinking about in terms of usability. If your backyard is in the south or faces the south, it's like, it's going to be hotter than the edges of.
I think about it as cool or not cool, but not in terms of price. And of course that's part of the price. Hey, let's throw out the Haven Lifeline and tackle some of life's most important questions. Our friends at Haven Life Insurance Agency, they put what you value first. For you, it's got to be living next to the train tracks.
North facing backyards in Texas.
Of course, yes. That's why they've made buying quality term life insurance actually simple. It's actually because you value loved ones and your time. They say here on my little script, head to stackybenjamins.com/Haven Life now, and you'll get a free quote. Application simple online. You get an instant coverage decision. We talked earlier about using software. OG, I love their quote tool because it gives you a range. And I think that when it comes to life insurance, it is a range, not a set number. Probably my favorite customer facing tool that I've seen. StackingBenjamins.com/Haven Life tells them that we sent you. And today we're going to throw out the lifeline to all the way over to Mumbai, India, where Niranjan is going to say hello.
Hi, Joe. This is Niranjan from Mumbai. Love your show. Been years now. I'm listening to it and love it. Sometime back, you guys had said that replacing a home loan for one with a lower interest may not be all that good. Something to do with the way the amortization tables are structured. Somehow I could never understand that. Would it be possible that you explain that on the next show or whenever you get time? My size is a medium, by the way. Bye.
Hey, thanks for that question, Niranjan. And I have to say, OG, when Niranjan first wrote me, and he and I have written back and forth several times, just the fact that we had someone listening in Mumbai, India, I just found thrilling. My wife did some work there and lived there actually for a couple months. Can't wait to go. Just can't wait to go. She speaks about her time in India very, very fondly. And it's good, Niranjan, to hear your voice finally on the show. But let's talk about this, OG. The issue with refinancing, Niranjan, is this. It's that when you look at the interest rate that you had versus the interest rate that you're going to have, depending on how late in the mortgage or how early in the mortgage you are, that interest rate assumption of the interest rate you're getting rid of isn't necessarily true. So if you get halfway through your mortgage, you've paid a huge interest rate because the bank makes sure that they got all of their money first. And you're locking in not maybe a 5% rate that you had to get a 3% rate. You're locking in maybe an 18% rate.
Yeah, because, you know, you just look at the payment that you've made. We all get these statements every year that say, here's the interest that you paid on your house this year. Compare that to your total payment. And in the first several years of your mortgage, dare I say probably 10 or 12, if you're a 30-year mortgage person, the interest payment is always more than the principal over that period of time. In fact, that was a goal of mine after the third year of seeing that on our mortgage statement was I said, no matter what, from now on, we're going to pay at least the same amount of principal as we do in interest every year because I don't want to see that number be. No. Anyway, so yeah, if you calculate it, if you look at it and say, well, I'm 12 years into this mortgage, you add up all the interest that you've paid versus the principal. And then you say, well, I'm going to refinance this because I'm going to get a 1% lower rate. You're going to do that process all over again, which may not be bad.
It might not be bad.
It may not be as good as you think.
Right.
Here's how I've calculated it for us. We have a 30-year 4% mortgage, or we had a 30-year 4% mortgage, and we are paying it off over the next 15 years. So that's the automatic payment. So you can figure out the math and say, okay, this is how much I've got to pay to make this mortgage balance go away in 15 years. Now I've got a new mortgage when I was comparing this at 2.85% for 15 years. And now here's that payment. And then I multiply those two things out. And I say, well, if I do this payment times 180 payments and this other payment, which is me just making myself pay a 15-year mortgage times 180 payments, this is how much the delta is. And that's really where you can compare the difference. You know, it's not fair to say like I have a 4%, I'm going to 3%, so I must be saving a ton of money. In this case, I am, but it doesn't always work out that way.
Well, and here's where just trying to do this in my head, OG, I get confused and maybe you can help me, which is let's say that I'm 2/3 of the way through a mortgage that's at 5% and the bank has taken these huge interest payments from me for the first several years. I would think then the rest of my interest payments, because it works out so that my average interest rate was 5% over time, right? Which means the rest of my payments, if I just hold on to this mortgage from here on out, probably are substantially less than 5.
Right.
Like that's a sunk cost that's already gone. And when I'm looking at 5 versus 3, I'm looking at the entire term of the mortgage. So the rest of my term might be at 1.5%. I don't know. I mean, it depends on where you're at in the mortgage, but seeing that the way that an amortization table works really changed my viewpoint on refinancing. If it's early in your mortgage, I think definitely continue to lock it in, right?
Right.
And also, I think if you can do something called a rate and term mortgage, which I've seen less and less of these days, but if they will continue your same term that you're on, but they will lower the effective interest rate so that you're on a 3% table versus a 5% table, then by all means, have at it.
Yeah, and you don't get what you don't ask for when it comes to this sort of stuff. I mean, bankers aren't total idiots. Most of them are, I guess. But
you're saying most of them are total idiots or aren't? Let's clarify.
Yeah, they are. They are total idiots. Most of them are, but they're not always. Especially if you're working with a credit union or a local community bank, you might be able to kind of negotiate a little bit of that and say, hey, I've got this mortgage at 4%. I'm already 10 years into this 20-year term. Can we just change the interest rate from here on out? They might be willing to do it.
Thanks for that question, Nir and John. That is something we have not talked about recently. So I'm glad you brought that up. And once again, great to hear your voice, my friend. And thanks for hanging out with us these last several years. All right, that's going to do it for today. A couple things. Before we came downstairs, I noticed Mom standing by the fridge, and she had another review on the refrigerator. This one comes from Steak Brother. It's 5 stars, called Laying the Plane. See where this is going?
Oh, boy.
Come for the personal finance aviation analogies. Stay for the day-old coleslaw. Boy, those jokes don't get old. This podcast features some of the best trivia on the internet. Both listeners have yet to learn anything, though. Succinct and yet still eviscerating commentary and 5 stars. Mom, super happy with that. Thanks, Steak Brother, for that one. Although I'm fairly certain, OG, that that's not actually Steak Brother, because Steak Brother doesn't know half of those words.
Knowing him personally, I don't think that he could put those sentences together.
Come up with something like that. And last, if you're someone, as we dig our way out and begin the recovery, which I'm so excited about the recovery, head to stackybenjamins.com/OG if you need better help in your corner. OG and his team, again, have the doors open for new clients. And so to get on his calendar, stackybenjamins.com/OG. One last thing, mark your calendar. We're going to talk about this in the Stacker First and also on Facebook, but I know many of you don't do social media. June 17th, 7 to 9 o'clock p.m. on our YouTube channel, we are going to have a session that we are tentatively calling Restacking Your Benjamins, Road to the Recovery. And we will be announcing lots of the guests coming up, but I am very pleased to announce that one of the companies joining us is going to be Fidelity Investments. And on Wednesday, we'll talk about another one of the companies. Fidelity did an interesting study about how many people are paying attention to their money and how they're paying attention to their money. And during our 2-hour event, we're going to talk with them about what type of paying attention makes sense and what type of paying attention does not make sense. So June 17th, our YouTube channel. Hope you can join us there.
Be there, be square. Isn't that something that the old people would say?
That is definitely an old person phrase. All right. That's going to do it for today. Doug, what should we have learned today?
Oh, come on, Joe. You broke my cover. All right, fine. I'll tell everybody what they should have learned today. First, take a lesson from our headlines. Your advisor doesn't use any software? Just remember, you need advice and benchmarks to reach your goals. Second, take a lesson from Tracy McLaughlin. You need to know what to market when selling your home to get the most money out of the sale. But the big takeaway? Turns out, Joe's mom isn't the next Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. I just accidentally left a trail of crumbs down here to the microphone, and I even had some chocolate on my face, you know. Okay, I ate the cake. I ate the cake, Ma. And I really need to get my act together and be able to put the fork down. Jeez, it was so worth it, though. Big thanks to Tracy McLaughlin for sharing all her wisdom about selling and buying homes and how not to leave money on the table. Too bad Joe and our producer Karen didn't have this book before they sold their homes last month. You can find all of Tracy's information at TracyMcLaughlin.com. And of course, you can also find all her links on our show notes page, StackingBenjamins.com. This show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I just jumped the shark. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. And before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor. Big thanks to Joe's mom for getting the oven going again. I smell cookies. Not that I'd, you know, have any. I would definitely wouldn't take any. But, oh, they smell good.
I remember in high school when that line came out, be there, be square. And everybody was saying it. I could tell you definitively, this is either 1985 or 1986, be there or be square. And
what? No, this is much older than that.
No, it definitely came out then.
Google's going to come.
Cause that's when I first heard it. Oh, gee, I can't be wrong. I can't be wrong.
Idiomatic word square originated between World War II and the 1950s.
Whatever. 1986 or 1985.
I was like, this is way older than that. The dictionary says, anyway, sorry, go ahead. You tell your story. It's way better. So in 1985, you learned a phrase that was 30 years old at the time.
But for our school dances and all of our school stuff, our high school committees adopted a new phrase, which was be there or go home. And that became our motto, be there or don't be there.
Wow. Such a way with words in Western Michigan in the mid 80s.
We thought we were clever. We were so clever.
It is very clever. Be there or don't be here.
Or don't be there.
You decide.
Yes.
Make your own choice. Don't succumb to peer pressure.
I heard, speaking of that, so I have this golf game that you've played. It's called the Golf Club 2019. They're actually coming out with a new one that's going to be called 2K Golf. As you're playing the game, the announcer in this game, and my understanding is the company that makes this golf game is Canadian, but the announcer sounds incredibly Canadian. You've played it. He sounds, every once in a while, has just a little Canadianism. Nothing wrong with that. He says a word that I heard in the 80s that I haven't heard since. Last night, I am playing golf with my brother-in-law. Rip one down the middle of fairway like I never could in real life. It's a beautiful shot. The commentator says, that shot's pretty decent. Now, we've had this discussion, my friends in Texas, and I said, man, I haven't heard that word since the 80s. And they all started laughing the first time I heard it a few weeks ago. And then my brother-in-law, we were having this discussion again last night. I said, I haven't heard that since the 1980s. And all of them all said, never heard that word before or that word abbreviated like that before. Did they say dece where you grew up? That's pretty dece. No.
Not to my knowledge. My kids were playing Sea of Thieves yesterday and they were pretty impressed that I knew what it was with their buddies.
That game.
And they were the pirates of the ocean.
Oh,
they were the just like, eh, let's go. Oh, there's a ship. Let's go attack them. And they just, that's all they were doing. You know, I don't know if they're good or bad at it. All I saw was I went up there and my son was swimming to his boat because they left him in the water. And they're like, hurry up. You got to swim faster. And he's like, guys, wait for me.
That game is such stupid fun. But I'm definitely an old guy playing that game. You know, we do these missions. And one mission, we have to find chickens. So we're on this island. My cousin and I run around this island with our cartoony guys. The game's great, by the way, a ton of fun. And we're way up high on the cliffs and I hear boom, boom, boom. And I know exactly what's going on. So we both go look over the edge of the cliff. Here's probably OG's kids in a ship right next to my ship, just
Just sinking it.
Setting it aflame.
When your ship goes down, what do? You just restart?
There's this like merman who's out in the water and has a torch, and you swim out to the torch and it gives you a new ship like halfway across the map. So what we did, my cousin kept looking for chickens. By the way, joke was on your kids, OG, because there was no treasure on that boat. It was just, I know they don't care, but
they don't care. They're just all about like,
they're just
wrecking stuff,
being a pirate. And so I went halfway across the map, got the new ship while he rounded up the chickens and pulled in, jumped on board. But I have yet to be in, I haven't played that game very much, but every fight I've been in, I've died. Well, this show's over, Stackers, but you know what? It's Military Appreciation Month, and that means that we've got time still for a shout out to members of our community, members of our family who have served our country. And you know what? Today, I want to give a shout out to two of my uncles, my Uncle Henry, who is in the Army. Let's do three. My Uncle Eddie, who is in the Army, and my Uncle Bill, also in the Army. And two of them served in Vietnam. One served in Korea. And a big thanks to all three of my uncles, my dad's brothers, who served like he did in the military. And this Military Appreciation Month, Navy Federal Credit Union wants to celebrate not just my uncles, but they want to celebrate their members who go above and beyond. Navy Federal offers member-only exclusive rates, discounts, and tools to empower their members and help them reach their goals. Of course, you may be eligible for Navy Federal membership and you don't even know it because it's open to all branches of the military, veterans, DOD employees, and their families. They're all eligible, and I want to reiterate, and their families. If you have family, like I do, who served in the military, well, then you're eligible for Navy Federal membership. Navy Federal's employees are part of the community they serve, and many of them are military family members, reservists, or veterans. Here during Military Appreciation Month, Stackers, go visit NavyFederal.org/celebrate, and you're going to see all of Navy Federal's Military Appreciation Month offers. So many cool things they're doing for veterans. You'll also see all their other awesome 24/7, 12 months of the year offers. That's NavyFederal.org/celebrate. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.